two lines way back at the antenna tuner, I could connect the two lines together as a short circuit and feed them with reference to ground. I could put equal RF energy on the right-hand line, on the left-hand line. And now when I use the light bulb, the neon light bulb, I will see equal brilliance on the right side and the left side. And so now I've not made a differential voltage on the line, I've made all pure common mode voltage on the line. So it's a good test, but as I said, it's a necessary but not sufficient. There's ways that that could give you a phony indication. Very similar to this device that we plug into our three-prong wall and the wall. This device that has two green lights and a red light telling you that you get the ground and the hot lead and the return lead are wired correctly. If all three wires are wired incorrectly in your wall socket, you'll get the right indication out of that. You'll get a misdetection of a bad wiring, if you know what I mean. So it's a good test. Let's do it. Let's do all of the above. By way of the new balloting device that you're about to supply, by way of a Berg wattmeter going into the balloting device or the antenna tuner, with all of these tests being performed in Massapequa Park, we're going to get to the bottom of this. And with any further comments, give me a call. Letters right now. K2I.
Repeater. Time out.
Go ahead, Eric.
Just curiosity, I don't know the tuner that he's using, but I have experience like on the 10 and 20 kilowatt FM transmitters when you go to tune it up for the first time. You can actually tune it in the wrong spot. It looks like you got in the right place, but you're actually tuning up on the harmonics. Is there any possibility of that happening?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. On some of these tuners, you can hit what looks like the right tuning in two different places, but only one of them is really the right place. Not easy to explain what's going on there, but yes, that's possible. Again, by way of proper instrumentation, the Berg wattmeter going in, you know you're putting 100 watts forward, you'd like to see less than a watt coming back when the antenna tuner is hooked correctly, is aligned correctly. And the fact that he's getting an arc over and a lot of RF in the shack, where he can draw an arc on the handle, the metal handle, and that's strong indication. Him being 20 some odd feet away from the dipole would not give him that effect. No way in hell. You don't have enough effective capture area of the human being, so to speak, to create enough RF person, RF I mean a human being, 20 feet away from an 80 meter dipole to create an arc. So something else is going on here that's worthy of further investigation. And with any further questions or comments, give me a call. Letters right now. K2IW in the TechNet.
N2OTG.
N2OTG. I should know. You start off with your name, sir, and then go right ahead with your comment.
Good evening, Dick. This is N2OTG. Name is Bob. It so happens that I'm using a Cobra, and I think I'm using the same model Palstar tuner as Rich. And I'm using a different Balun, though. I'm using the Balun that that was recommended by the manufacturer of the Cobra antenna. I forget the brand name of the Balun, but if you go to the website for Granite State Antenna, which manufactures the antenna, they have a selection of two Baluns. One is heavy duty for if you're running an amplifier, and one's light duty. But let me let it drop, please. My Cobra antenna seems to be pretty forgiving as far as balancing is concerned. The antenna runs north south, and the north leg of the dipole sort of takes a bend to the west, and it's lower than the south side. But I still get no RF in the shack, and the Balun seems to do a really good job. The Balun is mounted outside the shack, about 20 feet, and the antenna is only about 25 or 30 feet in the air. So anyway, that's my experience. This is N2OTG.
Yeah, good experience, Bob. And what you've described, a little bit of a bend on one side, a little bit lower on one side, to the human eye that looks like a lot of imbalance. Radio frequency-wise, that's an extremely minor amount of imbalance. If one half of my dipole was buried in the middle of a very dense evergreen tree, and the other half is flapping in the breeze, completely open to air, now you're starting to get to an environment where you're going to get a measurable amount of imbalance of the dipole. And in theory, you could make that come out correctly by having the right kind of an RF choke. I mean, if you had a few turns, if it was being fed with coax cable, with a bound at the antenna, and you did a belt and suspenders and did a couple of turns of the coax cable before it goes into that bound at the antenna, acting as an RF choke at that point, you could stop all RF coming back down that line, coax in that particular case. You don't have that option with open wire line. Nobody's come up with a good technique for making a poor man's balance on an open wire line. So, and by the way, I'm reasonably sure the problem is not coming from the antenna, so therefore you wouldn't even want to do that if you could do it. We dropped it. So as I hear more and more of the description that Rich is giving us, he's got strong indication of a significant amount of RF in the shack. And with further testing and experiments, we're going to get to the bottom of it. And maybe the answer is the particular bound he's using is not as good as it's claimed, or maybe it's defective, maybe it's been damaged. We'll eventually find out. With the right kind of testing, we'll find out what's going on. So hang in there, Rich. Good news is coming, it says here. Next person on my list was Eric, KE2EJ, our local broadcast engineer.
Quick comment, first thing.
Go ahead, John.
Yeah, we don't want to overlook the point that Eric just brought up about the harmonics. Very important, especially with the Henry and that power he's using. It's extremely important to tune at the minimum wattage when you're doing that. That will reduce the effect of picking up a harmonic and tuning to the harmonic. So we want to make sure he's using the least amount he needs just for indication. I believe that might help and eliminate it. If that's the problem, that will eliminate that. Just wanted to make that comment. KC2WGP, back to you, Dick.
John, do you have experience or have you heard stories of people tuning up an antenna tuner after a Henry 2K and coming up with a crazy tuning because they did it at high power versus low power? Give us a few words on what you've heard on that one, John.
KC2WGB. Absolutely, Dick. Not only the Henry, but other high power ones. But the Henry, I've heard a couple of complaints on when they were tuning up. They were pushing maybe 1,000 watts when they were doing the tuning, and they were tuning up on a harmonic. Now, whether the harmonic filter may have been defective or something like that, I'm not sure. But when they lowered the wattage and they got down to maybe 150 watts, they could see they were way off, because now when they moved the adjustments, they found another spot, the sweet spot. So what Eric said was very important, I believe.
And my first guess in that point would be that the internal standing wave ratio indicator in the antenna tuner can possibly be fooled. There are ways that you can fool an antenna, the visual indicator, when it's tuned to a harmonic, or if a harmonic is present. So going to a lower, more reasonable power level usually gets you out of that region where that's possible. Eric, KE2EJ, go right ahead with your question, Eric.
HRIWK2EJ. Now, this is going to be interesting. I'm working on a project where I've got an FM station that's in West Orange, New Jersey. And on 4 Times Square, I put a booster transmitter, licensed for 0.0049 kilowatts. Now, here's the interesting thing. I have a system that is synchronous. Both are being driven by GPS. The pilots are being driven by the 1 PPS, which is actually delayed. You actually delay one audio and the weapon signal going into the booster transmitter. Now, here's my question. Okay, it's a little bit complex because you've got the pilot, you've got something called RDS, which is another subcarrier, and the idea is that they're all supposed to be synchronous, and you calculate the point where the two stations overlap one another. With me so far?
Yes, I am, Eric. There's lots of guys on 10 gates and above that are using the one pulse per second out of their global positioning satellite receiver as a method of what they call disciplining the oscillator. Their rubidium oscillator running at 10 megahertz, they want to get one part in 10 to the 9, one part in 10 to the 12 frequency accuracy. And so there are various ways that you can take that one pulse per second coming out of a GPS receiver, but you got to be careful. There's a number of ways in which you can sync to the wrong harmonic, so to speak. Over you, Eric. K2LIW.
Okay. Yeah, I agree with that. And that's actually not the case in what's going on here. Things are definitely synchronous. The RF output, if you look at it and you compare it, which is really not an easy thing to do. Anytime you put an amplifier in line, there's X number of microseconds delay or nanoseconds worth of delay, which will mess you up. But now my question is, depth of modulation. If there is a difference in depth of modulation between the two stations, now the two stations are relatively close to each other in terms of line of sight. And the idea is that the station is kind of weak. The idea here is to cover Brooklyn. There's a directional antenna that's pointed southeast off of 4 Times Square. What are the effects in your mind in terms of the modulation depth of the actual audio, the two? Because when you listen on an FM receiver, the capture is going to play, it's going to be the ruling thing here. But with the mixing of the two signals, and let's say one deviation is slightly less by 2 or 3 dB than the other station, what do you think the end result is going to be? How much precision do you think is required to minimize the effect of that?
Make sure that I understand what's going on. In West Orange, New Jersey, I think there's an FM broadcast station. You've got a booster station or a local repeater, whatever it's called, in 4 Times Square. And if this is the best of all worlds, they would both be in their FM modulation thoroughly tracking. Therefore, a person sitting midway between West Orange and 4 Times Square would think that those two signals are F-wise, are thoroughly synchronous during the modulation interval. However, if a person is listening east of 4 Times Square and he's simultaneously getting enough signal from West Orange a further distance away, even if the stations are perfect, he would think there's imperfection there. He would hear those two signals growling as they beat against each other during the modulation. And Andy DeBay2CDL ran into that problem headlong with the work he was doing with the MTA. Over to you, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. So, you got to remember, here you have a full-power station and a micro-power station working on the same frequency at the same time. The end result of where I'm at the moment is actually as I drive around Manhattan and head towards Brooklyn, where there's a difference in capture. Because the audio levels are different, you'll hear it pop. You'll hear the difference in level. It's a clean transition. F-wise, we're doing good, but the difference in audio level is kind of annoying. Although, in theory, because this thing is being driven digitally, actually both transmitters are being fed by a T1 circuit, there is a device which actually distributes the audio and tracks the T1 line so that the delay between the two are maintained precisely. I've got to get past this little problem where even though everything is set the same and in theory you're supposed to have the same amount of deviation, modulation depth between these cases. Now, either I'm fooling myself and I hear that difference in modulation because it's hard to make a measurement of one station and then the other station. So, could this be a summing effect between the two stations, or do I actually have a level difference between the two? Is there anything there? What would be your opinion? And by the way, the directional antenna, as far as we're concerned, is really facing east down, so that the calculated that the mixing zone between them will be over the Hudson River.
I'm guessing that when you used your instrumentation at 4 Times Square, you measured the deviation ratio, the peak-to-peak deviation, which I think you're allowed to go plus or minus 75 kilohertz on FM broadcast, and you know that you've got that level set identical to what's at East Orange. West Orange, New Jersey. However, because of the time delay, the RF time delay, assuming that both antennas are thoroughly tracking, but now depending on where you set up your receiver, if you can set up a receiver in such a way that you get near similar amplitude of RF, but there's a much greater number of miles to one station versus the other, therefore the difference in miles and the normal 1 nanosecond per foot or 6 microseconds per mile of RF time delay at the speed of light, you start adding that in there, and you think that, hey, we're talking about low audio frequencies, like a PL tone, for instance, could create all this grief because of time delay at the RF frequencies in the MTH system. And now you add to that these two different instantaneous carriers because of a difference in time delay. So the exact frequency of the instantaneous carriers are being captured in a funny way by your limited discriminator in the receiver you're using. I think you can get some really peculiar effects where if you were able to put a... let me drop this. If you were able to put an audio spectrum analyzer on the output of, let's say, for instance, a service monitor, would that show you the effect? I don't know. I do know that because of differences in time delay of two signals that track each other, when you're midway between the two sources of signal, you can end up with this growling effect because the signal you're closest to will seem to be sweeping faster than the one that's further away because of the speed of light of that time delay. Therefore, instantaneously, there's a frequency difference that's going to create a growling. In other words, the RF carriers are beating against each other because instantaneously there's a frequency. So to make FM systems thoroughly track when there's anything more than hundreds of feet between the two, you're going to get some peculiar effects, and there are places where you can mount a receiver that it's going to be unhappy. Andy ran into an awful lot of that, and boy, there's no glamour fix for that one, Eric. I guess the only thing you can hope for here is that the antenna patterns are such that there are very few people getting both signals near identical RF signal strength. KE2EJ, K2IAW.
All right, let me clarify a little bit. K2IAW, K2EJ. No, I understand perfectly what you're talking about. But I can actually monitor the pilot, which you're running at 19 kilohertz. And let's now assume that we're beaming this radio wave in a straight line for the moment. Okay, where the RF and the phase of the RF, when it arrives from West Orange at 4 Times Square, and what's emanating at 4 Times Square is precisely in phase. Okay, so even when you're getting the capture effect, you don't get any beating, you don't get any growling or anything. It's clean switch as far as the receiver is concerned, the other source, except that the audio is, say, 2 or 3 dB down. So what I'm really asking, if I take two signals, okay, in terms of FM deviation, not so much for the RF carrier, if the FM deviation is not matched precisely, okay, is this the effect that I'm going to get?
You've got at 100 megacycle FM frequency, roughly. It's a little bit below 2 meters. You've got 7 or 8 foot of wavelength. Every time there's an 8 foot wavelength, 8 feet of difference in RF path length from transmitter A to your receiver versus transmitter B to your receiver, every 8 or 9 feet is 360 degrees of phase shift. That's just at the RF carrier if there was no modulation. So therefore, if there was no modulation, you're just listening to dead carrier, and you walked around with your receiver, you would see a bunch of peaks and valleys of the signal strength meter. Now you add modulation, and therefore the audio is at a much, much lower frequency, but still there is a phase shift of the audio because of path length, because now you've got the ability to have miles of difference of path length between signal A and your receiver and signal B and your receiver. So therefore, they're during the modulation, they're beating against each other. You could, when there's absolutely no modulation, you could locate your place, locate yourself at a place where the two signals are now thoroughly in phase. You're getting a peak of your signal transmitter. And all of a sudden, the modulation comes along, and now you're going to hear a growling effect. That's exactly what Andy saw, because there's no way to make RF zero time delay between transmitter and receiver and do it for two separate systems that are miles apart. There's going to be a lot of funny effects. Your only defense, as I see it, is carefully designed antenna patterns to make sure that very few people can locate themselves in a place where they get nearly the same RF signal strength. Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2J. I hear you, Dick, but the way this system is designed, okay, that it's going to take X number of nanoseconds for signal to, from West Orange to reach four times square. Now, there's a system that you actually set the delay. So the audio that's being transmitted is, say, 0.0 source in time. And let's say it's a total of 10 microseconds when you finally get to four times square. The audio being fed to four times square is delayed by 10 microseconds, so that the audio is precisely in the same position as the incoming RF. So at that point, they're perfectly matched, although there is a huge difference in signal strength, whereas if the four times square signal in Manhattan is, say, 20 dBu, just to help having a number, and the signal coming from West Orange is, say, 2 dBu. So you know that the receiver is really going to capture the four times square signal. But there will be spots where, because of buildings and stuff like that, where you're going to pick up the 2 dBu signal. Audio timing is going to be precisely the same in the same direction. We're just making this a straight line so that we don't have to deal with the difference of angles and the difference in path length between the two. But once we start putting vectors there, we know that there's going to be a time difference. So what I'm really asking is, can two perfectly in-phase signals change the amount of deviation that the receiver sees?
And the way you pose the question, the answer is no. It can't happen. I had the impression, though, from what you're saying, Eric, that if you had a handy talky FM receiver and you walk around in the environment so that the individual, because there's lots of multipaths going on. New York City is a marble canyon of buildings, and you're getting a zillion bounces of all of those buildings. I think you're telling me that as you walk around with that handy talky, you can find places where the audio output from that receiver in your hand changes. Is that the effect you're hearing right now, Eric? Go ahead.
Actually, yes, because you can look at the pilot, because that's generated internally by the engine inside both of the modulators. And you can actually look and see if that, because you can use a GPS, another GPS operator in your test setup, and move around and see that those pilots stay within like 1 or 2 degrees of phase of each other, even as you move off the axis in which the antenna is beaming, so to speak. And as you go into a spot where you don't hear one transmitter and you see the other transmitter, they're still in phase with each other. That's why I'm asking about the audio. So my thinking in terms of doing summation between the two signals, as long as the rising peak that's hitting, say, 270 degrees or 180 degrees of an audio signal lines up perfectly with another 280 degrees of audio signal, in AM this is easy to figure out, but in FM it's a little bit of a different story now, isn't it?
Yeah, if you go the next step, if you make the mistake of going the next step of taking the instantaneous Fourier transform of that FM modulated signal with all those zillions of side lobes, and all of them have individual amplitudes and individual phase angles, and you try to figure out with multiple signals being received what's going to happen. Whoa. It'll drive you kind of crazy. Rough rule of thumb, Eric, as you walk around with a handy talkie FM receiver, where you're in the vicinity where you're close enough to four times square that you're getting a lot of signal from it, and because West Orange is a lot higher power, like 20 or 30 dB, you can find places where the two RF signal strengths are similar. And now, as you walk around and you're listening to the audio output, make a rough guess. You've heard the audio go down by 2 dB or 20 dB, and because you're listening to a stereo signal, which is now using this fancy phase demodulation of the 19 kHz pilot on that 38 KC subcarrier that gives you the A minus B versus the A plus B, you get some other funny effects. I wonder if you tune your receiver in the non-stereo mode, only listen to the A plus B, and reject the A minus B, I wonder if you would still hear the same effect, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Wow, what I did, because I had that spot, is I put both transmitters in mono, so there was no subcarrier, so there was no pilot. But I used the pilot as a method of finding weapons, because I can actually put that up on a scope and clock it with the GPS receiver and see, you know, take a absolute phase measurement and then compare that. I haven't gotten as far into this as I'm going to, but I suspect, because now don't forget, these exciters are digital exciters, meaning that they actually run the whole audio engine is a DSP. The whole method of creating the modulation is a DSP. It's not like there's a whole series of reactors that are doing the job. So in theory, when I set the numerical values to the audio input and deviation, when I put two of these things side by side, they should produce precisely the same output. And my thinking is at this point is that it's not doing that.
The two digital signal processor signal generators, digital generators, let's call them. I can't remember direct signal generator. I can't remember the vocabulary that's used for this. Are they the exact same brand name and model number on both locations, Eric? Go ahead.
Yes, they are, and the stuff that does the interconnection to them is also the same manufacturer. And in essence, when you're sending digital audio, there's nothing to vary the level. When you send out a note that comes up as a numerical number is 127, it produces, say, 25 kilohertz worth of deviation. And it does it precisely in both of them, in theory.
Now, is there an internet connection involved here? Because there are times when the latency of the internet does some funny things, even though you think you've got a dedicated line. Or maybe you've got a dedicated...
No, this system runs over a T1 line, and it's designed precisely to track the delays of the T1 line.
Okay, then your answer is it can't possibly be happening. Your ear, when you're listening to that audio, hear the audio drop off. Is it because you've moved the handheld receiver in a particular location? What are you doing at the instant that you see the audio drop off is question number one. And question number two, rough calibration with your ear. Is it dropping off 1 dB or 10 dB? Over to you, Eric.
Dropping off maybe a dB and a half by my ear, maybe 2 dB, which is kind of hard to tell. But the interesting thing is, when I shut off the transmitter in West Orange, the audio level of the 4 times square station doesn't change, which says to me that I don't have the same amount of deviation.
That's a very strong clue. So you're hearing the effect, which you think is 1.5 dB down of audio, and you thoroughly turn off the RF transmitter at West Orange, and you're only listening to 4 times square, and now you're still hearing low audio. Boy, that sounds like an awful strong indication that something funny is going on at 4 times square. I can't think of any way that West Orange can create some kind of a permanent change in four times square, where you can turn on one or the other, where you have the ability to command like it's time to recheck the real deviation. And did it change from the time you set it? When you were at the four-time location, and you think you set the deviation just right, did something change between then and the time you walked away? So when you turn off West Orange, and now listening to only four times, and it's low in audio, boy, that seems like an acid test right there, Eric. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, let me give you a little quick insight on how I got involved in this. This system was set up by the manufacturer originally, and when they tested it, they had all sorts of beating problems and swapping problems. You could see that the pilot drop out and come back, and all sorts of weird things. I've gotten past that, but they never set it up right. They never hooked it up right. They never actually trained the pilot to run off the 1 PPS. Which is the major mistake that I corrected. Now, I'm just getting into this, so I was trying to do some math to try and figure out, well, let's say I have something that's deviating, so just for the sake of it, 1 kilohertz, and I had something that was deviating at 1.1 kilohertz, what happens when I mix the two of them together? But that's all fine and dandy, but when you finally come to think about the way FM receivers work, and they capture the strongest signal, that kind of theory goes out the window, but yet I'm asking myself, even though there's a little bit of that other signal at the front end, is that having an effect in the IF or further down the chain in the...
When you read Baghdadi's book, Lectures on Communication System Theory, an oldie but goodie, I think it's a 1950, I think it's a McGraw-Hill, they talk about these extremely high capture ratio FM demodulators. The bottom line is that you have a relatively simple limiter in your receiver. And so the usual definition of capture is when how many dB weaker must carrier B be compared to carrier A, such that after demodulation, the modulation on carrier B is 20 dB suppressed, coming out of the loudspeaker, so to speak. That's one of the definitions. And so there's a way of building an extremely high capture ratio receiver where you start with a very broad bandwidth and a limiter, followed by a bandpass filter and amplifier and another limiter and so on. You can't just cascade limiters. I mean, if you put three limiters in a row, you don't get much of an improvement. But if there's differences in bandwidth between the individual limiting stages, and you get the extremely high capture ratio. So Baghdadi showed you a schematic diagram. Let me drop it. I should say functional block diagram, where when you use this, I can't think of the man's name right now. There's a guy's name, not Baghdadi. There's a guy's name that's associated with this limiting technique. He was able to make a receiver where if the weaker signal in RF volts is 0.997, that's 0.03% weaker, so to speak, 0.003 as a ratio of weaker, the undesired signal would be suppressed by 20 dB when you take this to the limit. So because you've got a non-ideal limiter, one stage of limiter in your receiver, not the three-stage thing that Baghdadi is talking about, you think you're getting capture. Without a doubt, a lot of the undesired signal is being suppressed, but it's still there, and it's still adding in a vector manner to your final audio output and doing some funny things. And in your case, my first response was that it's creating crazy phase. It sums the differences of the 19KC pilot, which in turn is changing... a phase shift of the 19KC pilot can do some funny things to the 38KC demodulation of your A minus B. But when you turn one off, boy, that's a beautiful test. I think it's time to go back to four times square and really measure what is the deviation under working conditions of you, Eric, K2LAW.
Yeah, I agree with you, Dick. I really wanted to get your opinion on this whole thing. You gotta remember that it's an on-air working station, so there's a limit to how much I can play with it. I'm doing this at like 2 o'clock in the morning for a little while. The thing that really got me going was I could go to Brooklyn, I could drive anywhere within the radiation pattern of the four-time square antenna, and, you know, have a clean signal. And even as it switches, even as the receiver catches, and by the way, we're talking about normal commercial car receivers, handheld FM radios, as the method of test, you know, no laboratory equipment is allowed in this testing because nobody else has laboratory equipment, so, you know, I've got to deal with what is typical. So, a couple of the things that I would like to do, I'm not going to get the opportunity to do because that affects listeners, you know.
Well, lucky for you, you're one of these kind of ham radio operators that on occasion can do your thing at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning when very few of the customers are listening. Therefore, you get away with murder with running tests. It says here, my guess is broadcast transmitters, television broadcast transmitters, occasionally get turned off at 2 or 3 in the morning to do antenna testing. Is that true, Eric?
No, I know you're not too much of a late night person, with which you are, by the way. But, of course, when they were rebuilding the mooring mast on Empire, all the stations went off here all at the same time. Although some, if you go back a couple of years, I had put up high beam standby antennas on the 81st floor setback, and it was easier then. But now the standby antennas are the lower part of the mooring mast. And what they got to do is as they climb up, turn off, make sure you're on the standby antenna, get to a certain, the main antenna, get to a certain point, and then switch over to the standby antenna. And there are some stations that aren't on the standby antenna because standby antenna is VHF, not UHF, so you get the idea. But, and any time you turn your transmitter off, that, of course, has to be logged, and so on and so forth. If you're a commercial station, that makes them very unhappy because the dollars stop rolling in.
Sounds like you're having fun, Eric. Now I know why you get into conversations with John, KC2WGB, sometimes at crazy hours when you're coming back from New Jersey. And sometimes you're stopping off at Empire. Okay, good luck with that. Let us know what you discover, if anything. Sounds like it's time to recheck deviation at 4 Times Square. The next person on the list was Bob, W2OSR. And Bob, what would you like to discuss tonight on the TechNet? You got it, K2LAW. I was fairly sure he's going to be back at EQTH. I guess we've gone down the list of people who signed into the TechNet. We've gone an hour and 45 minutes almost, hour and 40-something minutes. Time for the mailbag, John. And if Bob comes in later, we'll pick him up. KC2WGB, what have you seen so far tonight on Echo Link, chat room? How many people are tracking us in how many states, how many countries? Has your mailbag given us some more of these deep questions that are going to drive us up the wall for a while? Some of these questions you get are really goodies. KC2WGB with the mailbag, K2LAW.
Can you come with a quick comment?
Go ahead with a quick comment. Give me your call letters again.
Bravo 2, Golf, X-Ray Mike, Rich. I want to thank you guys for in the direction of W28, Eric. That was wonderful. Made the operation of pin diodes crystal. It also explains very handily why the high frequency. On very good ground today. Thank you.
Very fine, Rich. Glad that information was helpful to you. Yeah, there's an art and science to pin diodes. When it comes to the pin diodes you can easily buy these days, they work much better at the higher frequencies, 500 megs and above, so to speak. A pin diode is intentionally made as a diode that RF-wise is very slow in response. And if you've got a diode that's only a good rectifier at, say, for instance, 10 megacycles, and you're using it at 500 megacycles, it doesn't see the RF. And therefore, even though the RF from your transmitter might be, let me pick a number, 50 watts on a 50 ohm line, where it's hitting a peak of 1 ampere RMS, which is 1.4, let me call it 1.5 amperes peak. If you're using a fast diode, you'd have to have at least 1.5 amperes of forward bias. Make sure that during the RF cycle, your diode switching between transmit and receive doesn't become partially open. But if it's a pin diode, if it's a diode that's intentionally super slow, you may be able to buy it with 20 milliamps instead of 1.5 amps. And so circuit-wise, that becomes a lot nicer. If you can buy a pin diode with a low enough frequency response, and there's the problem. So I have the impression...
You can get them down to 30 megahertz, no problem.
Okay. If I wanted to make a TR circuit at 80 meters, I don't think that diode would work very well for me. What do you think, Eric?
Down there, it absolutely won't. But there are other methods to do that using regular diodes.
Without a doubt, a regular diode will do it. But if the peak RF current coming out of your transmitter is 1.5 amperes, if you're using a regular diode, you've got to have 1.5 amperes of forward bias average. Otherwise, the diode is going to become a partial open circuit during a portion of your cycle, and you're going to be generating some pretty nasty harmonics. Over to you, Eric, on that one.
Yeah, it's true. But the nice part about pin diodes is you only need a little bit of forward bias, and it's the capacitance of the diode that's really doing the work.
You could call it the capacitance of the diode. You could call it an excessive reverse recovery reverse voltage recovery time. There's various ways you can call it. But it's got this great big intrinsic region between the N region and the P region that intentionally makes it a very slow operating diode. So now you've got a conflict between the switching time and the pin characteristic, so to speak. So any ordinary diode that's got a high enough current capability would give you a beautiful TR switch if you're willing to bias it far enough, forward hard enough compared to your transmit power.
And fast enough, because if you drop the bias voltage, you start to see it affected by your RF.
If you're using real good differential keying, kill the exciter. You kill the transmitter first before you ask the TR switch to switch from the transmit to the receive mode, or vice versa. Okay. So John, what are you seeing when you do all your monitoring today? And what kind of tough questions have you gotten from your mail people? K2WGB with the mailbag. K2IW and TechNet. You got it, Eric. All right, you got it, John.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick. Hello, everyone on the net. School's out, so it's a little quiet. Most of those tough questions come when they're having classes. Now, let's see. Echolink, right now we have 7. We had 8 before, so it's pretty busy tonight on Echolink. Chat room's quiet, but I do have 2 or 3 questions here that warrant testing. Right, let me let her drop, and I'll go on to the first question from a gentleman named Chris. Alrighty, Chris has been working on some test equipment, and a lot of the test equipment he has, the older stuff, only has a 2-wire AC cord, and he's been changing it over to 3-wire with a grounded pin. And he'd like to know a little information about the effect, any of the operation of the instrumentation. And maybe you can let him know if there are any conditions where he could be going into a minefield. I can think of a few, but maybe you can give him some advice and your consideration on converting the old 2 wires to 3-wire. That's grounding the chassis. Back to you, Dick.
This is DPC with a comment. Go ahead, Al. Okay, first of all, it's a no-brainer. If you have older test equipment, old HP or general radio, a Bolton, the smartest thing you can do is put a 3-wire cord on. The reason being, this older gear has transformers that have a lot of age. It's very easy for a transformer to develop a primary short to the shell on the AC line. It'll give you a hot chassis on your instrument. So definitely advisable to put 3-wire cords on. And also it helps if there's any, on a sensitive measuring device, sensitive AC voltmeters and stuff like that, you can develop ground loops. But when you have a 3-wire cord, it's just a no-brainer. Anything we put out, I change over the 3-wire cord before it leaves, for mainly safety and liability. Go ahead, Dick. K2RW, K6DPZ.
Yeah, I agree with that. The 3-wire cord, properly installed, almost always increases safety. The worst case I remember is my Heathkit AR2 receiver, the very first Heathkit I built. Way back in the late 50s, That was my my general coverage receiver with a Q multiplier added to it, and that's how I was doing a ham radio operation on 80 and 40, and mostly 80 and 40 meters. It was about a poor receiver, anything higher than that. However, it had a two-wire cord, even though it had a real power transformer. To make sure that the two-wire cord was not picking up stray signals, there was something like a 0.02 disc ceramic capacitor from each side of the 110-volt cord to lead to chassis. So that, and I think in those days, in the very early days, the two-wire prong, it didn't even have a big prong and a small prong. You could plug it in either way, if you know what I mean. And I do remember on a couple of occasions coming down to my ham shack in the basement early in the morning, didn't have shoes on, bare feet against the concrete floor, and I would touch the metal chassis of the, you know, one of the tuning knobs, so to speak, of the Eastkit AR3 receiver. And because the chassis was on this capacitor divider network, you could say the chassis is always operating 167 volts above ground, half of 125 volts. And 67 volts above ground, you can definitely feel it between your hands and your feet, so to speak. Not enough to easily electrocute you, but it's uncomfortable. And so that was an extremely good example of why three-wire prongs are required. Ensure they're wired correctly. If you wire it incorrectly, so the hot lead from the 110-volt line goes to the chassis, my goodness, can you create grief. There's various ways you can test for that to make sure you've got it right. So,
repeater, timeout.
Give me an example, John, where you know of somebody doing a what looks like a correct installation of a three-wire cord to a previously two-wire instrumentation where it could create grief. I think there are very few of those. KC2WGB, K2RW in the TechNet.
KC2W with the comment.
Okay, we're going to pick up Eric first. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I'm going back into the old days when I used to fix guitar amplifiers. What they would do is they would put a switch, a double pole switch that was wired across, which would switch the two wires of the power line. So they had those stupid caps going right to the chassis. So they hit the microphone and you felt the tickle and you flipped the switch the other way. Just a comment.
Wow. When you felt the tickle, you touched the microphone, you felt the tickle, that's one lead. Where is the other lead that's completing the circuit that allowed you to fix feel the tickle? Is that between the microphone and the amplifier that's connected to the guitar, so to speak? Eric, go ahead.
It could be any number of paths. It could be on a stage without a metal floor, microphone stand. If you look at old microphone stands, they had these big rubber bumpers to try and isolate you. Could be between two different guitar amplifiers, or you had a keyboard connected to it. And in those days, even though they had transformers, they still did that with the power line. And that was before they started making two prongs, the fat prongs. But eventually, all went to three wire. But that's what they did. And you look at any of the amps from the 50s, 60s, and 70s, you'll find just that in them.
Now, once in a while, a microphone circuit will pick up some extra hum. I expected you were going to tell me they flipped that switch in order to minimize the hum pickup. Was that ever possible, Eric? Go ahead.
On many amplifiers, there'd be another switch just for that. And that was a cheat. What it basically was a ground lifter. Because the microphones were very unbalanced. And even the inputs to the guitars were balanced, but a lot of the stuff was single-ended, so, the outside was whatever was you connected to, you made it hot.
By the way things used to be done, and the risk that we've taken, the number of times when I could have electrocuted myself, like I remember once thinking a transformer was disconnected, and it wasn't. I ended up grabbing the two leads of a 850-volt secondary winding. And thank goodness it was a very light touch to my fingers where I picked up those leads. So, John, tell us your description of where you believe that a person could get in trouble if he's not careful when he's installing a three-wire power cord. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, KC2WGB. Well, it's due to improper operation, basically. What would happen is they would use their meters, say some of the BTBMs, transformer operated or not. What would happen is you have a ground lead on there, and they would be making measurements without networks, direct connections, and the actual case of the old BTBM was metal, and it would be at whatever the voltage the ground lead was connected to. Well, the problem is, now when you change over to a three-wire cord and ground the complete chassis and the frame, now that ground lead is a direct connection to ground, and as soon as you attach it to something, a hot chassis maybe, it will cause a fuse to blow or cause some damage in the circuit you're measuring. So if you do that, you just have to be sure you know what you're doing as far as operation, but many people use those two-wire instruments improperly, in my opinion, without isolation transformers, and allow the cases to run hot on the bench. So there you can really get in trouble. And I agree, three-wire cords should be on everything. And, yeah, Eric, I remember those bitches, people getting bitten from the microphones. That was some crazy things. But things like that, Dick, that's the only issue, and it's all due to improper operation, nothing other than that. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
You still have that problem today, TV repairmen and, you know, people fixing stuff, especially switching supplies, because you got 110 volts going in there. Flip your scope onto it, you get this huge arc.
Yes, a number of modern-day switching-type power supplies have no power transformer, no isolation transformer. They take the 110-volt line, rectify it directly to 160 volts, and then do switching on that. And in the best case, that rectifier circuit is completely floating from the chassis, and only after the switching transformer does the grounding to the chassis take place. But with miswiring, flooding, things can happen. So you gotta be careful. There was another point I was gonna make along these lines. Forget what it was now. Oh yeah, the good news is that our digital voltmeters these days are almost always battery operated, thoroughly floating, in a plastic case, 10 mega ohm input impedance. So they're capable of really easily measuring crazy voltages. You could if you want to. Let me drop
6DPZ with a comment.
Hal, recognize. You could if you want to. Find out which lead of your Christmas tree wiring is the hot lead, which is the cold lead, by taking a digital voltmeter and grounding to something that you know is really ground, the negative lead, and in the AC millivolt range, hold the other lead near the wiring of the Christmas tree lighting, and find out, you can do troubleshooting to find out where the bad bulb is, if you know what I mean, to find out the lead is hot up to this point, and all of a sudden after that bulb, it's not anymore. Therefore, that bulb is an open circuit. They sell you a little bit of the device that does that for you. That's a handheld device with a light-emitting diode in it and a battery inside, and a capacitive probe on the front end, and you become the ground that completes that circuit. But there's ways of doing that with your digital voltmeter. K6DPZ, K2RIW, go ahead, Al.
K2RIW, K6DPZ. I just wanted to say, you know, you're working with AC/DC, you're working with switching supplies, where, you know, there is a danger in those. Easy thing to do. You go to the Radio Shack, if you can find some stores that are still open, yourself two Radio Shack transformers. They make 110 volts to 24 volts, 110 volts to 12 volts. The highest current filament transformers you can get. And just get two of them, tie them back to back, where you go in 110, you drop down to 12 or 24, and then you go back up to 110. Makes a beautiful isolation transformer. It's cheap and dirty, and you can save your neck. Go ahead, Dick.
You can also buy an isolation transformer.
Forget how did it get, Eric?
Yeah, they're kind of pricey. And the winding of the transformer you buy from Radio Shack, in Hal's case, if it's a 12 volts or 10 amperes, which you know is therefore 120 watts, so this homebrew isolation transformer, you can push it to 120 watts. If you've got a 500 watt appliance, like say for instance a hairdryer, that transformer, you maybe get away with it briefly, but I think you're going to overheat windings. Anybody have any comments on all the above? KQIW.
I'm talking about working with switching power supplies. You're going to draw maybe 2.5 amps, which you can handle with two transformers back-to-back, and they're not that expensive at Radio Shack. Isolation transformers are very expensive and hard to find.
Comment, Dick?
Where would you guys go to buy an isolation transformer these days? How much would you pay?
I'd buy it from DigiCase.
I have.
Depending upon how many watts, it runs anywhere from 30 to like 50 bucks.
That's pretty nice. John, go ahead on your comment.
Okay, the simplest way to do it, Acme. That company makes transformers, control transformers. You can get them with 120-volt primary and 220 secondaries. And you can just wire them up any way you want. They're good isolation transformers, very inexpensive. And if you're working on small stuff, it's fine. I think you can get them up to a couple of kVA, and that's usually enough to operate small stuff, like test equipment or TV, something like that. And it's very safe, and they stand up very well. And the name of the company is Acme. It's available at any electrical supply store.
Take a couple of Bell transformers and tie them back to back.
Those Acme transformers you're talking about, John, roughly what's the price of those?
I think they're about 25 bucks. I got 6 of them here that I use in my lab, and I've had them for years.
The 25 buck version is good for roughly how many watts?
I'm not sure of the VA on them. If I remember, I think they were 250 VA.
That's a lot of steam for an awful lot of circuits these days. Okay, go with your next question, John.
A ground loop.
2WGV. All right, next question comes from a ham who has a desk that he operates, and he has 3 microphones. They're all connected together. They're all dynamic microphones going into a common transmitter. Transmitter gets keyed up. Now, his question is, he doesn't want to interrupt the RF. He wants to be able to switch microphones, and he'd like to know if he had a shorting switch, which would place a short directly on the microphone, the dynamic microphone. So if someone wants to speak, they would press a button which would open the switch, turn on that circuit. And when he's finished, when he lets go, it will short that circuit the next person can pick up. He would like to know if you see any problems with that, or is that something he shouldn't do? Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB. Maybe Eric has a comment on it also.
K6DPZ with a comment.
Yeah, the first thing I was going to do is pass it over to Eric, because he hooks up a lot of high-quality microphones in broadcast. But we're going to go to Hal first, and then Eric in that order. Go ahead, Hal.
Okay, if you want to have those 3 dynamic microphones, so you can run any of the 3, you go through about a 25K resistor to each mic, and then you use a switch to ground out the mic. That way you can still utilize the other mics when you push the switch in, and they all could be connected. Go ahead, Eric.
I stepped out for a moment. Repeat the question for me.
Okay, Eric. John, repeat the question for Eric, who just came back.
Okay. Eric, gentleman has 3 microphones, the dynamic microphones going into 1 transmitter, and he wants to install a shorting switch. The RF will stay on all of the time. And when he is finished speaking, when he releases, it will just jump out that one mic. It'll put a dead short across the mic, and then the other mics can be used. Do you see any problem with that, or any hesitation in doing something like that? Over to you, Eric.
Mics in parallel?
Yes, they go into a little amplifier box individually, and then they leave that box. So there's a little control box involved. Exact circuitry, I don't know, but what do you think of that system?
All right, if he's going into a mic mixer, and he's got volume control on each one, commercial mics like a Shure 55SW, the SW switch, the switch essentially pushes short across the line so that there's nothing coming out of it. If he's going into something that is a summing amplifier, meaning that each input is simply a resistor, but before it goes into the input of an op-amp or a transistor, that will actually cause loading on the other microphones to drop their level. In that case, you could use something like a 5K resistor and use that to short out the mic, but you will still get a little bit of leakage.